What can you do when your friends get sick of you prying into their problems?
Do what everyone else is doing, of course. Start a podcast.
Introducing If I Speak, a brand new podcast from me, Ash Sarkar.
And me, Moya Lothi McLean, where we pitch each other our big theories about the universe, share the intrusive thoughts keeping us up at night, and best of all, tackle your personal dilemmas.
We'll be asking questions like, does tabloid gossip turn us all into conspiracy theorists?
Should you financially support a parent?
Is Moya turning into a bit of a femcel?
Yes. What's Ash's most toxic trait?
Interrupting! From dating disorders to family feuds, career dilemmas to online etiquette,
the political gets personal on If I Speak.
Find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's gossip elevated.
Hello and welcome to this Intelligence Squared podcast. I'm Farah Jassat. And before we go to this week's episode, I want to share some exciting news. We've recently launched Intelligence Squared Plus, a new digital subscription service for online events. If you're a fan of our podcast, you can now listen to them while they're being recorded. You can join our most high-profile speakers in live, interactive online events and ask your questions directly to them from the comfort of your home. We have an amazing lineup over the coming months, from authors like Margaret Atwood and Salman Rushdie to big thinkers like the New York Times columnist Thomas Friedman and the economist Thomas Piketty, as well as the big names in arts and culture like the singer Paloma Faith, chef Yotam Ottolenghi, and podcaster Elizabeth Day. If you still need convincing, here's a message from our friend Stephen Fry.
Hello, I'm Stephen Fry, and I'd like to encourage you to subscribe to Intelligence Squared Plus, the new and very modestly priced digital subscription service from my friends at Intelligence Squared. You would, I think, be hard-pressed to find an organisation that better presents and supports debate, discussion and civilised, rigorous conversation. Perhaps never before has the world needed all of these things quite so keenly. Perhaps you'll be kind enough to support Intelligence Squared by signing up for this service. It only costs £5 a month. Do consider it. Thank you very much indeed.
So there you have it. If you're interested, please do click on the link in our podcast description or go to intelligencesquared.com. We hope to see you virtually at one of our online events very soon. And I'll now hand over to my colleague Connor to tell us more about this week's episode.
Thank you, Farah, and hello, podcast listeners. This week we have Sarah Posner, author of Unholy: Why White Evangelicals Worship at the Altar of Donald Trump. And Sarah spoke to Brian Klass, Washington Post columnist and host of the Power Corrupts podcast, and they delved into questions like, why does Donald Trump, someone who seems almost antithetical to the ideal Christian conservative male, have such a powerful and close relationship with the religious right in America? So it's a really interesting conversation, very relevant for any of you who saw that image of Donald Trump outside the church holding the Bible just a few weeks ago in the midst of protests, and we hope you enjoy it.
Hello, I'm Brian Klass. Thanks for coming on the podcast, Sarah.
Thanks for having me.
So I wanted to start with the sort of big picture here. Let's imagine that there's somebody who's gone into a coma in early 2015, and they've woken up today. And they have realized that one of the core bases of President Trump's support is evangelical Christians for this very, very unchristian man. How can you explain this if you had to do it in sort of a nutshell?
In a nutshell, there was a significant part of the white evangelical base and a not insignificant part of the white evangelical leadership that affirmatively liked Donald Trump from the get-go. And then the ones who were reluctant to support him either faded away, isolated by their brethren who decided to support Trump, and the rest of them came on board liking the fact that he was going to be a strong leader who was more than willing to give them the reins of power to enact their agenda through policy, to nominate judges who would solidify that agenda in the law.
That is a very good summary. So I think, you know, one of the things that I wanted to start with is what's in the news right now before we take a step back and look at some of the precursors to this, but is the now infamous moment where Trump and the White House cleared Lafayette Park in D.C., not far from where you live, and, you know, tried to basically make a photo opportunity with Trump holding the Bible aloft outside of a church. What is this? How is this playing out in religious communities on the religious right? I mean, is it something where it's backfiring in the same way that it is for the broader electorate, or is this seen as yet more proof that Trump is on their side?
It is seen as more proof that Trump is on their side. There have been a couple of people, you know, maybe who've questioned it or questioned the intent to use force against protesters. Like Pat Robertson made some remarks on the air on his 700 Club show on the Christian Broadcasting Network that sort of suggested that he was pushing back on Trump's use of force.
He said it was not cool, didn't he?
Not cool. But, you know, that statement got a lot of play in the secular media. But if you watch the whole program, those comments were followed by a news segment in which Trump was portrayed as this strong leader who was protecting the public from radical Antifa activists, protesters in the park who needed to be restrained so that Trump could show the world that he was going to protect churches from them. Now, of course, the church itself did not want Trump to come there, did not appreciate being used as a photo op. And in fact, amid all the tear gas and pepper spray, law enforcement had tear gassed and removed priests, Episcopal priests, who were on the patio of the church at the time, handing out snacks and water and so forth to protesters. So it definitely shows this divide between Trump's religious base and other religious figures who are outraged at what Trump did.
Yeah, I mean, there's this moment early on in the book where you talk about how, you know, Trump doesn't even try to craft a religious narrative around himself. His personal story certainly does not lend itself to that narrative anyway, but he doesn't even make the effort. So where is this sort of moment? Is it literally just when he gets elected, when people coalesce around him and the religious right? Or is there a moment during the primary where he becomes sort of the religious right's second choice? I mean, where is this tipping point where he goes from, you know, the sort of we'll live with him to the he's our champion?
So an important thing to understand about how the religious right came to support Trump is that for several decades, the religious right leadership and the base following suit had all of these litmus tests for presidential candidates. They had to have a personal salvation story. They had to be able to talk about how they would govern from a biblical worldview or from a biblical perspective, how they would restore the Christian nation. They had to have a perfect record on abortion and LGBT rights, being opposed to both, that is. I mean, you'll remember that the religious right was extremely skeptical of Mitt Romney in 2012 because he had, quote unquote, flip-flopped on abortion. There were questions about whether he was a real Christian because he's a member of the Church of Latter-day Saints. And even John McCain, you know, was not really their perfect candidate either because he didn't really talk about his faith that much. So it seems very mysterious why they would fall for Trump. There were a few things going on. One was that a significant part of the Christian right base really liked his racist, nativist message that he had coming out of the box in 2015 when he launched his presidential primary campaign. The other piece of it is that Trump has a lot of ties in the world of televangelism. His current top spiritual advisor and White House advisor on faith-based issues is Paula White, a very popular and well-known televangelist. And the third is that ultimately a lot of Christian right leaders ultimately made a pact with him to support him if he would let them do what they wanted on judges and so forth. And they subsequently became extremely enthusiastic about his presidency. So some religious right leaders who had supported someone like Ted Cruz, who's the son of a Baptist preacher and really speaks their language and really, really pandered to what they wanted, have now started calling Trump the most pro-life and the most pro-religious liberty president in history. So it's not just, it wasn't just transactional. It was that he, that his strongman tendencies, or his willingness to be what they call a disruptor and a strong leader and a problem solver, really was the core of the appeal. And they were willing to cast off their long-standing demands on religiosity, using the excuse that sometimes God chooses someone who's maybe not Christian or not religious to come save America at this point in history when America is on the precipice.
Yeah, so I wanted to pick up on that a bit, because there's this moment that really stood out for me when thinking about Trump's sort of the paradox of Trump being so not a Christian person and being this sort of emblem of the Christian right. When he's asked early, I think it's in early 2016, when he's asked to name his two favorite Bible verses, and he completely dodges. And then the follow-up is, are you more of an Old Testament or a New Testament kind of guy? And it's like a Saturday Night Live skit. I mean, he says, probably equal, right?
Right.
I mean,
it's right.
Like he's just has no idea. It's never occurred to him to think about this before. So did they know that he's not religious, or do they sort of secretly suspect that he's privately a Christian? I mean, what is that dynamic?
So that's a really interesting question. So I think at the time, there were people who said things like, well, like James Dobson said in June of 2016, after this huge meeting where like 1,000 evangelical leaders came to New York to meet with Trump and basically seal the deal. I mean, he had essentially already clinched the Republican nomination. But
and remind people who James Dobson is?
So he was the founder of Focus on the Family. He's no longer at Focus on the Family, but he's a very important figure in the religious right in terms of defining what kinds of quote unquote family values Christians should have, and also played a very prominent role throughout the 80s and 90s and 2000s in giving his stamp of approval to candidates. He played a big role in pressuring the Republican Party to pander to these quote unquote Christian values. And so after this big meeting in New York, Dobson told a reporter that maybe Trump was a baby Christian, you know, so like he's coming along, maybe, you know, he's on the way to being saved. But some people just acknowledged that, hey, look, sometimes God just chooses somebody who's not a believer to carry out his will for America. And that's what Trump is. He's carrying out God's will for America to restore it as a Christian nation, or they sometimes say a Judeo-Christian nation. And to them now, as his administration peels away and scales back LGBT rights and civil rights and expands religious exemptions for Christians who object to reproductive rights and abortion and so forth, they are seeing him as, like I said, the most pro-religious freedom president in history.
So I wanted to just break this down a little bit for people who are a little less familiar with the religious right in America, because it's not just all Christians, right? I mean, we're talking about specific subsets. And could you walk us through which denominations tend to be most pro-Trump and which parts of the Christian church in the U.S. tend to be most progressive?
So when we're talking about Trump's evangelical support and even his support from mainline Protestants and Catholics, this is overwhelmingly support from white people. So obviously there are historically black denominations, and there are mainline Protestant denominations. So like historically black denominations like the African Methodist Episcopal Church, for example, or mainline Protestant denominations like the Methodist Church or the Episcopal Church or the Presbyterian Church in the USA. And obviously there's the Catholic Church as well. And then evangelicals, there are denominations like the Southern Baptist Convention, but there are many, many non-denominational evangelical and Pentecostal and charismatic churches, many of which are not exclusively white. Many of them are, many of the non-denominational churches are often fairly diverse, but it's largely in these politically conservative and very white, non-denominational evangelical churches, Southern Baptists, that those more conservative denominations and conservative Catholics and conservatives, white conservatives who attend mainline Protestant churches. So Trump's support, largely his largest base of support is from white evangelical Christians who voted, 81% of them voted for him in 2016. And so that's why you hear him talking so frequently about his evangelicals and his evangelical support. But the religious right also includes white conservative Catholics and mainline Protestants.
And are we still talking, I mean, when there have been discussions of the religious right in modern American politics, abortion is always very, very central to that discussion. Is that still the case, or has Trump broadened that into a series of other issues in the culture wars? I mean, is he fundamentally different from sort of the darling of the religious right in terms of policy than the people we might have seen elevated by them in the 80s or 90s?
No, so abortion is still a very key issue for them. One of their goals is to make abortion illegal in the United States. Trump has been their ally on that. His nominations of Neil Gorsuch and Brett Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court were largely seen as aimed at overturning Roe versus Wade, which is the Supreme Court decision from 1973 legalizing abortion in the United States. But abortion, while abortion has come to the forefront of religious right advocacy since about 1980, and it has been, as I said, the litmus test issue for politicians, I think what Trump's successful candidacy and his presidency shows is that the roots of the religious right are not really in abortion, that white evangelicals became animated to get engaged in national electoral politics over other culture war issues that we're seeing Trump stoke right now, mainly over race and the government's role in addressing racism and racist policies. So back in the 1970s, when right-wing Washington political insiders who were known then as the New Right, these were sort of Goldwater Republicans who were trying to build a sort of third party against what might be called country club Republicanism. They were trying to get religious activists like white evangelicals into the fold. And the issue that animated these white evangelicals and fundamentalist Christians was that the Internal Revenue Service was trying to get private Christian schools to basically desegregate. And even if they weren't formed with the intention of being a segregated school in the face of school desegregation, many of them were all white, and the IRS was coming to them and saying, look, you know, you shouldn't be getting a tax exemption for enacting a policy or going against a policy that the United States considers an important public policy, which is school desegregation. And so there was a huge backlash against that, with the government being portrayed as infringing on the religious freedom of these Christian schools to have whatever policy that they wanted. And that was more of a triggering factor at the time than abortion was.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to me that what you're describing there also fits really well with Trump's initial Muslim ban proposal, right? I mean, so I remember in 2017, what ended up getting enacted was not as widespread as what he proposed in December of 2015. But in December 2015, he proposes to ban, you know, a total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the United States. Is this the type of sort of hint, hint, wink, wink, you know, nudge, nudge politics where he says it's about national security, or he says it's about economic policy, but really it's red meat for the evangelicals who are worried about religious incursion or transformation of the United States?
I think it's both. I mean, I think that there's a significant part of his base, including white evangelical Christians, who would say they see it as a national security issue, who've been sort of brainwashed by propaganda that there's like a Muslim fifth column in the United States that's trying to overturn the United States government or subvert the Constitution. You know, for a long time, there have been propaganda campaigns to portray Muslims as, like I said, a fifth column invasion force in the United States. So I think that white evangelicals have been on the receiving end of that propaganda in their media echo chamber, so to speak. And so I think that they're receptive to it on that level, but they're also receptive to it on the level of believing that Islam is anti-Christian and therefore anti-American because America is a Christian nation in their view.
So I want to change gears slightly to talk about something you've hinted at already, which is the sort of the spiritual people that Trump surrounds himself with. And this includes the advisors like Paula White, who you mentioned previously, but also Robert Jeffress, who was, you know, at Trump's inauguration and has said some pretty controversial things, including hinting or suggesting that Barack Obama was the Antichrist. And then, of course, there's Mike Pence, who is actually somebody that religious right conservatives identify with, and he identifies as one himself. So could you walk us through each of these in turn? You can pick your order of them, but I'd like to talk about Pence, Paula White, and Jeffress, and sort of the role they play in maybe making Trump more palatable or translating Trump's tweets or his language to a base that may not be his natural home.
So I'll start with Paula White, because Trump and White have been friends since probably the mid-2000s. And there's a story that many people tell about how they met, many people, including Paula White herself, which is that Trump, who likes to channel surf, came upon her television show when he was channel surfing at, I don't know where he was, Mar-a-Lago, maybe, I don't know. And that he then asked to meet her. He was so impressed with her preaching that he asked to meet her, and his secretary called her up and arranged this meeting at Trump Tower, and they've been friends ever since. And White has played an important role in introducing Trump to this world of televangelism where the belief system is, this is called the prosperity gospel, and people like White teach and their followers believe that God wants you to be rich, that God will bless you with like a thousandfold return on your investment if you sow a seed with your pastor or a televangelist that you see on TV. Meanwhile, the televangelists, you know, are flying around the world in private jets, and they have fancy cars and fancy houses. Paula White owns a condo in Trump Tower in addition to her home in Florida. And so Trump, in this context, is seen as a very successful and godly person because he is rich. He may not really be rich. We don't know that. But, you know, he's presented as rich. He may be very in debt, but we'll see. We don't know that because of not seeing the tax returns. But that's a separate issue. And so White has played a very big role in introducing him to this world, making him palatable to this world. And this is a very important component of the Christian right base, people who believe in the prosperity gospel and people who watch televangelists on TV. Jeffress is a Southern Baptist megachurch pastor who has told me that, you know, denominations don't really matter anymore. So to the extent that the Southern Baptist Convention, for example, has made efforts to address race relations and racism in its history, or has had prominent members be critics of Trump, Jeffress waves all of that off. He basically says, you know, denominations don't really matter anymore. There's just kind of like evangelicalism and Christians, and, you know, I might have more in common with a non-denominational pastor than I do with some of my Southern Baptist brethren.
Tell me, before we get on to Pence, so tell me about meeting Jeffress. I mean, what is this guy like? He's got Trump's ear. He's one of the faces of Trump's religiosity. I mean, you know, one of the things that I would want to, you know, say to him is, do you actually believe in this man? You know what I mean? Like, are you using him? So tell us a little bit about what it was like to meet him, what he's like.
So he's very solicitous and very charming in a way when you meet him one-on-one. He's very gracious. You know, I met him for coffee on the sidelines of a conference, and, you know, he was getting himself a cup of coffee and very much, you know, wanted to make sure whether I wanted a cup of coffee, and, you know, very overboard with that kind of politeness, and has always been extremely polite to me in our interactions when I interview him as a reporter. Yet, you know, like you see him on Fox News and he says, you know, he'll say any number of outrageous, terrible, and controversial things. I think that Jeffress really believes in Trump as a strong man. Trump as someone who is unafraid to just go ahead and do the things that he's doing without concern for political correctness or whether this would impact his reelection or bipartisanship. You know, I think that prior Republican presidents were concerned about their legacy or wanted to make sure that they maintained good relations on the Hill so they could get their agenda passed. I mean, Trump just comes in and stomps on everything. And that is precisely what they like about him, because I think they see him as not caving in to, you know, liberal scolds. And he's willing to carry out their agenda without worrying what the liberal scolds might say.
I want to add, so just to follow up on this, because the way you talk about Paula White and Robert Jeffress, it sounds to me, and this is my own editorializing, not your words, but it sounds to me like Paula White is more of a grifter who's using Trump because they have aligned views and she can raise money out of their relationship. And she seems like she's taking advantage of other people's religiosity for personal gain. And it seems to me like Jeffress is more of a true believer who's got goals in mind around religion, but that he's using Trump not for financial gain necessarily, although I'm sure that's part of it, but because he has a certain agenda. I mean, do you think that that's an accurate portrayal of them, that there's different wings of people around Trump, some for financial gain, some for actual agendas?
I think it's both in all cases. Yes, there are a lot of people around Trump who are using their relationship with him to boost their celebrity. There is no doubt about that. But I really do think that they really believe that, I mean, maybe they cynically believe it, but when I talk to people, they seem to, not only people in sort of these leadership positions, but also just regular people who attend a conference that you meet and interview, they really believe this, that God wants Trump there because America is on the brink. I mean, the through line in my book is about how the Christian right and the alt-right, you know, the sort of white supremacist, you know, upstarts that came into the campaign because Trump electrified them so much from the outset, that the through line of the book is that these people are opposed to liberal democracy, right? They're opposed to all of the social and legal change that happened in the United States from sort of, you know, 1950 onward. So it's not just, you know, that they're against abortion. They have issues with, you know, Brown v. Board. 11 of Trump's judicial nominees would not say in their confirmation hearings that they believed that Brown v. Board of Education was rightly decided. They oppose sort of the United States' role as an international promoter of human rights and democracy. And they oppose other, you know, and in the case of the religious right, they oppose other changes like women's rights and reproductive rights and LGBT rights. And so to the extent that Trump is willing to trample on all of that and promote this idea that there's a lost America that was lost as a result of all of this stuff, and that the people who should be in power are people like Paula White or Robert Jeffress or people, you know, Betsy DeVos or Bill Barr, that they affirmatively like this. It's not just about the grift.
I'd like to pick up there to talk about Mike Pence and also moving into some of the strongman dynamics. But first, it's time for a short break.
Sponsoring the show for this episode is Marquee TV. Marquee TV is a streaming service with a difference. It's bringing you the top tier of performing arts straight into your living room or onto your device. So think dance, theatre, music, anything you might find in the West End, Broadway, or maybe a cool little experimental space too, but saving you the cost of a few tickets as well. I've got happily a bit lost in their vast library of performances, exclusive interviews, and behind-the-scenes content. Choreographer Jonathan Watkins' interpretation of George Orwell's classic 1984 was pretty cool, and I love the dance piece Sutra, inspired by the skills of Buddhist Shaolin monks. And we've got a special treat for our listeners. Marquee TV offers 3 months of access for just 99 cents. That's right, 3 months for only 99 cents with the code squared. Simply visit marquee.tv and use the promo code squared to dive into the world of arts like never before. Bring the arts home with Marquee TV. Intelligence Squared is a tight-knit team doing big things, and it means we're always looking for tools that can help streamline managing tasks. That's why I want to talk to you for a minute about NetSuite. NetSuite provides cloud-based software to get things moving. Maybe your business has been humming, but you can feel things are falling behind a little bit. Or perhaps your team is getting snowed with manual tasks and closing those books is taking forever. If this sounds like you, you should know these three numbers. 37,000, 25, 1. 37,000, that's the number of businesses which have upgraded to NetSuite by Oracle. 25, NetSuite turns 25 this year. That's 25 years of helping businesses do more with less, allowing them to close their books in days, not weeks, and drive down costs. And one, because your business is one of a kind, so you get a customized solution for all of your KPIs in one efficient system with one source of truth. It means you can manage risk, get reliable forecasts, and improve margins. It's everything you need to grow all in one place. NetSuite is now making an unprecedented offer to make more of that kind of thing possible. Right now, you can download NetSuite's popular KPI checklist designed to give you consistently excellent performance absolutely free at netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared to get your own KPI checklist. netsuite.com/squared. We make a lot of stuff here at Intelligence Squared, so many great chats to enrich the mind like the one you're listening to now. But like any business, it's really essential to be in good shape and keep things efficient so you can see the big picture all in one place. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you can cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems, and it's super easy to get started because NetSuite exists in the cloud, so no hardware needed, cutting your IT costs too. And you'll also improve efficiency by bringing all your major processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. That's why over 37,000 companies have already made the move. The cost of living crisis might not be making anything any cheaper, but there's real value in feeling on top of things, which is something I experience firsthand as an event producer every day. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared. netsuite.com/squared.
Hello, I'm Farah Jassat from Intelligence Squared. I hope you're enjoying this episode. Before we get back to it, I'd like to encourage you, our loyal podcast listeners, to subscribe to Intelligence Squared Plus, our new subscription service for online interactive events. Intelligence Squared brings together the world's top thought leaders and opinion formers, from Margaret Atwood, Thomas Friedman and Salman Rushdie, to Mehdi Hassan, Bernardine Evaristo and Elizabeth Day. Join us and take part in these exclusive online events where you can ask your questions directly to our speakers. It's only £5 a month and you get the first month completely free. Please do consider supporting Intelligence Squared and subscribe now by clicking the link in our podcast description. Thank you so much.
Okay, so with Mike Pence, I wanted to talk about him before we move into Trump's strongman dynamics, because Pence is, you know, he's on the ticket for 2020 as far as we know. I mean, there doesn't seem to be any movement there. And yet there is some sort of, you know, potential tension at times in that relationship. Do you think that he is essential for sending the signal to evangelical voters that Trump is on their side, or has he sort of outlasted his usefulness for Trump?
He's still useful to Trump. I think initially when Trump picked him in 2016, it was to assuage any lingering doubts that white evangelicals had about Trump, because Pence is such a revered figure in that community from the time that he was a member of Congress, the chair of the Republican Study Committee, this sort of arch-conservative caucus on the Hill. He was always a favorite at events like the Values Voters Summit. He was also governor of Indiana. And so he's a very admired figure in those circles. He has, Trump has sort of outpaced Pence as being the hero, right? So Trump doesn't really need Pence anymore. And I think what's evident to me that Trump, that the base is behind Trump himself, as opposed to just being for Trump because Pence is behind him, is that they opposed the impeachment, right? So like if they thought that Mike Pence would continue to enact the policies that they wanted and nominate the judges that they wanted, why would they have a problem with Trump being removed from office? They would just get Mike Pence. It's really about that, well, first of all, that they would never want to submit to something that the Democrats or liberals or the deep state was behind in the first place. But also, I think it's just that Trump as a leader is seen as being more strong and robust and unyielding and loyal. And it wouldn't have been, I think it wouldn't have been enough for them to just get Pence.
So let's talk about the autocrat side of Trump and the sort of authoritarianism that comes with the strongman persona. You've got chapters in the book, God's Strongman, and also The Undrained Swamp, Loves an Autocrat. So we're hinting at this heavily, as you say, the through line of your book. Talk us about this sort of evolution of the embrace of the assault on liberal democracy, because people like Pence do pretend to sort of represent the part of the party that is much more, you know, in line with the at least the spoken affirmation of liberal democracy than Trump does. And yet there's this very concerted assault where, as you point out in the book, it's not just that they're okay with it, it's that the religious right embraces it. So talk us through how this actually functions, the dynamics of authoritarianism in evangelical circles.
So the religious right as a movement has long used the tools of democracy to gain power, you know, completely. I mean, like, it's legitimate to form a political movement and mobilize a get out the vote drive or mobilize citizen lobbyists to go to Capitol Hill and persuade their members of Congress about a piece of legislation or policy or so forth. I'm not trying to suggest that that was like an illegitimate use of the levers of democracy. But I think that what has become evident is that they think that they have a democracy if people can do those things, if people can go out and vote, if people can go to Capitol Hill and visit with their member of Congress and try to persuade them of their point of view and have a say in the policymaking or legislation. But what became evident to me about how they were willing to let go of other features of a liberal democracy beyond just, you know, pulling the lever in the voting booth or going to Capitol Hill, was the way in which they started to admire strongmen in other countries and sort of started to look to them as sort of a prototype of what a strong leader was. So people like Vladimir Putin or Viktor Orban or Jair Bolsonaro in Brazil. And when I have asked religious right leaders, okay, so how can you support Orban when what you have going on here is a dismantling of liberal democracy? They'll say things like, well, you know, those are just procedural things, right? And procedural things like, you know, eviscerating an independent judiciary or cracking down on a free press. What's more important is that he defends Western civilization or the Christian nation. These are all kind of buzzwords for the kind of democracy that they are looking for under Trump. And so, again, these are views that are antithetical to the values of a liberal democracy that, you know, promotes a free press, a separation of powers, an accountable executive branch, an independent judiciary, and crucially, supporting the human rights and dignity of all of its citizens. And by looking to Putin and Orban, and Bolsonaro and bolstering them as strong leaders of a Christian nation or a nation that's trying to get back to its Christian roots. They're really revealing what they want is a sort of quasi-democracy that's rooted in this belief that, you know, Western civilization or Christianity is under attack by liberalism.
Yeah, so I want to, I'll put my devil's advocate hat on for a moment and suggest some things that I don't necessarily believe, but what do you say to the people who would say that part of the reason for this is that the Democrats have fallen down on the job and that there actually is a real threat to a certain way of life, a certain type of society that white evangelicals are lashing out against, that they're, the way that they got used to the world is, you know, what, regardless of normative, whether it's good or bad, right, that they're actually feeling threatened in some way, and that Democrats could have blunted the appeal of someone like Trump had they reached out to them more and sort of held their hand to bring them into a slightly different type of society?
Well, I think that the Democrats did do that, actually. You know, so think of Hillary Clinton talking about that abortion should be safe, legal, and rare, or that, or efforts in the early to mid 2000s by Democrats to talk about abortion reduction or ways to have civil unions instead of same-sex marriage. There were a lot of efforts to appeal to anti-abortion and anti-LGBT rights folks by kind of soft-pedaling all of that stuff. And none of that really worked because on the right, like, so maybe you peeled off some people in the center, but on the right, those were seen as insufficient gestures. And they were incidentally also seen as damaging gestures by the left. And so I guess I would say that there were a lot of efforts made to make things go slower in that regard, but they didn't really work.
And is it a lost cause for Democrats to try to peel away any of these voters? I mean, is it something where on a strategic level, it's simply so ingrained in evangelical Christianity that they're the party of Republicans that Democrats should just give up on appealing to them for a generation? Or are there some inroads to be made?
Well, I think at the margins, so you know, roughly, you know, this has been fairly static for a number of years, roughly 20% of white evangelicals are Democrats or lean Democrat. And, but, you know, obviously like 80% is a very big number for the Republicans and it's crucial for them. It's crucial for them electorally. So obviously like making some inroads could be like a tipping point kind of thing, electorally speaking, if it could change the outcome in, you know, an important electoral college state like Michigan, for example, or North Carolina. But I don't think that it should be a concerted effort that Democrats should spend a lot of time on. It should be more of a thing of like, okay, look, you can be with Donald Trump, or you can vote for Joe Biden, or you can vote for, you know, whoever the opponent is of a Republican senator who is supporting Trump. I don't think that it's really worth a lot more effort, like the kinds of efforts that Democrats made in the mid-2000s to try to sort of soften their position on abortion or LGBT rights, or to talk about their faith in this kind of heavy-handed way. I don't think it's worth those kinds of efforts, but I think it certainly is worth signaling that, you know, the Democratic Party is open to any Republican who wants to abandon Donald Trump.
So I want to close our discussion in the last few minutes. We're recording this and talking as protests are raging around the United States in response to the murder of George Floyd. And this is something where, you know, specifically, there have been some moments where you really struggle to see the evangelical justification, the Christian justification to Trump's response. So, for example, you've had, you know, Trump come out with a tweet backing police over an incident in which they shoved a 75-year-old white man to the ground to the point where he hit his head and started bleeding on the ground. You have a clear-cut video of a black man getting killed by police after they kneel on him for nearly 9 minutes. And you still see, when we talk about softening of Trump's base or softening of his support in the polls, we're talking about tiny marginals, right? We're talking about small changes among evangelical support. So how do you explain this? Because I think this is something, when you think about Trump from Europe, for example, it's the thing that people are puzzled by the most, is they watch this and they have this image of what Jesus is supposed to represent in their heads and what Christianity is supposed to represent. And they see Trump's reaction and they see his base as Christians. So how does this play out in the Black Lives Matter dynamic and the George Floyd protests in terms of evangelical support for Trump?
So what I have seen in the past, you know, couple of weeks, week and a half, is that Trump's evangelical supporters will say the murder of George Floyd was horrible and unjustifiable, and, you know, the police officers who perpetrated it need to be held to account. But, okay, so there's no but about George Floyd himself. The but is about the protests. And the but about the protests is that these are, you know, George, all the conspiracy theories come roaring back. So, you know, maybe George Soros is funding them. Maybe the whole thing has been set up by George Soros. Antifa, you know, all of it is Antifa, and we need to crack down on them. They're, you know, Trump says, I'm going to designate them a terrorist organization, which he can't even do. And also, Antifa isn't an organization, but these kinds of conspiracy theories are extremely prevalent in the religious right media echo chamber. So, like, you know, if you, I think probably a lot of listeners are sort of vaguely familiar with, or maybe more than vaguely familiar with, some of the conspiracy theories that you'd seen on Fox News or in Trump's own Twitter feed. And these are the same conspiracy theories that are very prevalent in a lot of Christian right media also. So Trump is really playing to that by saying in the tweet this morning about the elderly man in Buffalo who was pushed down by the police. He sort of suggested that, like, you know, maybe he was some kind of Antifa plant and he was doing something wrong, like trying to read the police scanner or something. You know, I think we're going to just start seeing a lot more of this. And this is why, you know, haven't seen, for example, a lot of pushback on the tear gassing in Lafayette Square from that community, at least.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. The sort of dynamics of information flows in this community and in Trump's base are, you know, they're fascinating and disturbing. How big of a role in the Christian right are things like Facebook and online media and also fringe television media like OANN or some of the televangelists who are, you know, of course, overtly political in this moment? How much has this shifted over time compared to what used to be the sort of Christian TV channels?
OANN, I don't have a good handle on how much that is watched in that community or how much it's watched at all. You know, I don't know if it exists for an audience of one just to be amplified through his Twitter feed or what the story with that is. But I think that the televangelist style and sort of media myth-making that is used by televangelists has been essentially adapted by Trump, as opposed to Trump trying to use these to help support his view. So, for example, like the idea that there are enemies of Christianity or unseen forces, satanic forces trying to undermine America. These are sort of very common, prevalent themes in televangelism. The idea that you're engaged in spiritual warfare between the forces of good and the forces of evil. So when Trump is portrayed as this anointed leader put in office by God, he has God's hand on him, and there are these other anti-American or un-American forces trying to bring down his presidency, you know, it's not really that huge of a leap if you've sort of existed in that media ecosystem for a long time. So I think that the pre-existing televangelism and then their amplification of these ideas on social media and so forth has been in place for Trump's use, as opposed to he as opposed to he being the creator of these new kinds of, or the instigator of these new kinds of media.
So I think we're at the point of our last question. And normally I think it's tradition to end on a high note, but given that we live in a bit of a bleak hellscape at the moment, I'm not going to try that. So I want to look forward to November through January and into 2021. So, you know, we're looking at the polls right now. Trump is down, you know, an average of around 10 points in a lot of the recent polling that's out. His support is collapsing, even among some white voters, not the evangelical white voters, but some white voters. What happens with this group of people who have found a sort of messiah in the White House in Trump if he loses and they have to accept a Biden presidency that they've been conditioned for 3.5 years to believe is, you know, part of the deep state and their sworn enemy and the enemy of Christianity?
It's extremely worrisome because there was a backlash. So when Barack Obama was elected, right, we thought, oh, you know, now we're, we thought, some people thought, now we're in a post-racial society. We have a black president. But there was a huge backlash. There was a huge racist backlash against his presidency. And the religious right was very much a part of that backlash. So now that they've added in all of these sort of Trumpian conspiracy theories about the deep state and so on, you're right. It's a very worrisome brew, claims about voter fraud or, you know, a deep state conspiracy to bring down Trump. You know, we see these ex-military folks coming out against Trump this past week. You know, are Trump supporters going to try to spin that as some deep state conspiracy to defeat him in November? I mean, the possibilities of the conspiracy theories and the efforts to permit him to retain power or enable him to retain power, even if he loses, are frankly pretty terrifying. And even if he does engage in a peaceful transfer of power, if Biden wins, I think we're just going to see a very ugly period following his departure from office.
Well, that is an appropriately bleak note to end on for the 2020 hellscape. I've been speaking with Sarah Posner, about the author of the new book, Unholy, Why White Evangelicals Worship at the Altar of Donald Trump, and you can buy it anywhere good books are sold. Thank you very much, Sarah.
Thank you, Brian.